Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today's episode, we are going to be talking about ballads. What is a ballad? Why do they matter? What are they doing in conjunction with plays? Because one definition of ballad that I've been playing around with today, as I've been looking at so many potential ballads that we could talk about as part of this episode, is what is a ballad? Well, they're spoilers. I mean, you think you're going to go and watch a play, and bam, someone tells you the plot before you get there, and it's just, oh, well, all the surprises are gone. Oh, I think I'm going to go and watch Faustus. Bam, no, you've heard it in a song. Oh, I'll play about Godly Susanna. That'll be great. Bam, no, you've heard it in a song. Patient Grist. Bam, it's you know what you're going to see before you even see it. And that's something about early modern culture that perhaps we've lost today, in the sense of some of the stories and some of the references in other plays exist in the ether of popular culture, in song you might hear in the street, in inns and taverns, and just about or purchased on pieces of paper. And to tell us about some of those ballads and a specific project to make those ballads come to life and be accessible for people today, we have in the room three wonderful guests. And my guests, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
My name is Christopher Marsh. I'm a historian of early modern English culture. I work at Queen's University, Belfast, and I specialise in religion, gender, social relations, and today popular music particularly.
I am Angela McShane, also a historian based at Warwick University, and I'm a cultural historian. I'm particularly interested in popular politics through avenues of drinking and singing. And this has, by weird ways, led me to do the whole history of the ballad trade, which has involved a lot of drinking, but for completely different reasons. And that's what I do. I've done a lot of that for the project.
Hello, I'm Andy Watts, and I'm a freelance musician. And in connection with this project on ballads, I'm the founder and director, if you like, of the Carnival Band. And the Carnival Band are partly based in historical performance, or early music, as some people like to call it, going right back to the 16th century. But we also delve into folk music and traditional music of all kinds. And in this project, I was responsible for pulling together and getting together all the musicians, the instrumentalists and the singers to record the ballads for the website.
Yes, because we haven't really explicated. It is a website called 100 Ballads, which contains more than 100 ballads. So 100ballads.org, which there will be links to all these things in the show description at the end. But first of all, let's ask, you know, what is a ballad and why the website?
What is a ballad then? I mean, put simply, a broadside ballad from the 17th century is a sheet song. So it has the text of a song, often in the 17th century, some pictures, nominates a tune for the singing. These were printed in London, sold for a penny each, and also distributed around the country by itinerant ballad sellers. And in terms of how the project developed, I mean, I guess I was kind of aware as a historian, maybe kind of 20 years ago, that ballads were not really being understood as sort of scripts for musical performance. They were tending to be treated by academics as texts, basically. And so you'd see the text quoting, but you wouldn't see much about the pictures, you wouldn't see much about the tunes, you wouldn't see much about performance. So that was one motivation for the website, to kind of put the performance and put the music back into these ballads. And I suppose the other thing is that there was little awareness amongst people working with ballads of the importance of the success of particular songs. So we were tending to use ballads just, you know, pick a ballad that suits what you're looking for and use it. But of course, it's really important to make a distinction between a song that, you know, was successful for decades, centuries, and a song that just came and went briefly. So that's why we tried on this website to identify, using quite a complicated methodology, a sort of 100-120 of the best-selling songs of the period. So it's kind of putting the music back and focusing on popularity is the focus of the website, I think.
Yes, and talking of, you know, treating things as primarily as text, I mean, we and Beyond are just as guilty of that. One of your texts, I think we have done a read-through of Queen Eleanor being sunk down, is a text we've looked at, or I think it is a text, the same text. I haven't double-checked. And that you need people with the skill set to unpack what's going on with the music and the performance side of it. Angela, on the world of ballads, you know, how do they function in early modern society, you know, how they're sold, presumably, and when we're talking about a ballad, are we talking just the words and the song and the because they're discreetly right. different elements,
right? So, well, I think the thing that you missed out there, yes, they are printed, they're sold, they're sung, but let's go back to the beginning there. They're actually written by somebody or multiple somebodies, and then they are sold to a publisher who organises for them to be printed and then puts them out. And very importantly, that publisher doesn't publish rubbish. Okay, so among the things that have driven me to drink is working out all the finances behind the ballad trade, and the margins are tight. I mean, you can make money, but the margins are very tight, which means that they're not messing around. You know, they'll only take something that's good. I mean, they make mistakes like today's pop trade does. So that's quite important. What are they expecting then those things to happen? And they're trying to, as you say, you know, they're trying to attract people in three different ways. One is because they've got something they can keep, they can put it up, and they often are pasted up in, you know, alehouses, in homes and other sorts of things, so that they are a visual thing that people can enjoy in that way. They are constantly available to be read out. I mean, it's probable, you know, that a lot of performances were by reading out or just saying aloud. In fact, I was looking up plays, obviously, with with ballads in, and one was Fletcher's Monsieur Thomas. Is that right? Yeah. And he mentions in there one of the ballads, it's The Merchant's Daughter of Bristow. But Fiddler is brought onto the scene because he's the worst ever performer. So it's brilliant. And he's not actually able to sing and is renowned for only ever saying all his ballads. You know, he can't actually do the tunes at all. So there you go. So you've got a bit of a range of how they might be performed and how they might be enjoyed.
So are you saying that there's a full Shatner performance, William Shatner's famous speak singing of songs, is that's a legitimate performance technique?
Yes, I mean, I think that some of them are said, because there's a difference. But I mean, it's interesting that what Fletcher's done there is he said the guy is a fiddler, and then actually when like he's there in order to enable a bit of business to be done, really. And so the person who's hired him, Tom, says to him, "Don't tune your instrument. I want it to be, you know, I want it to be like Welsh or something wild," because he wants a terrible noise. That's why he's hired this poor fiddler. So you do get fantastic musicians who are able to gather enormous crowds of people. They're obviously really, really good. So you get a big range of potential performers, you know, industry, in obviously in theatres, outside theatres and so on, and others who may really have only just set out the first verse because they're just trying to sell sheets, really.
And of course, on the website you do actually have recordings of the music, and that's why we have Andy here turning this early material into performable music today. I'm assuming there are a lot of challenges in terms of identifying tunes to go with the actual words that we have here. Am I wrong on that front?
Well, Chris did the work for me. Sometimes the ballads specify the tune, so it's a well-known tune of the time. Examples, Flying Fame, Chevy Chase, and so on. Sometimes the tune is just called A Pleasant New Tune, something like that. And very rarely there's some musical notation, hardly ever. So this is something that's passed on in the oral tradition. And it's quite interesting, exactly what Angela's saying, that there must have been a huge range of performance styles. And one thing that I picked up recently, but I was reading Dickens, Our Mutual Friend, and there's a ballad seller in there called Silas Wegg. He describes what he has to do. He not only has to sell the ballads, but he has to teach the tunes to the people who buy them. And it made me start to think about these ballad sellers, that they may not have been musically literate, but they certainly, the best of them, must have been musically very competent, because they were actually teaching people what might have been a new tune. And some of these tunes are actually quite complicated. Some of them are very simple and slightly repetitive. But others, yeah, they come from the sort of world of the court and the virginal player and the viol player. I think Chris is going to chip in here.
No, I was just going to say there's a famous early 17th century example in a play by a man who we must not mention, where a ballad singer is also teaching tunes and texts to an audience. So that runs right through from the 16th century to the 19th century, the role of the ballad singer in helping consumers to you know, develop the skills they need to perform it.
And mostly, I think, in terms of performance, you have to think of an unaccompanied voice. So a single voice singing the song. Occasionally, there might be a bit of a chorus for people to join in, but basically it's a song, quite a long song, for a solo singer. Now, on our recording, we've occasionally added some instruments accompaniment, and this is done again through Chris's and Angela's research on the practice of the time. So we've used the fiddle, we mentioned the fiddle already, the cittern, which is like a flat-backed mandolin, to produce a simple chordal accompaniment, and sometimes some homemade instruments, like a homemade dulcimer, which would be just a string stretched across a box and hit with sticks, or maybe, an upturned cooking pot as a percussion instrument. So there's so many different ways that that you can perform these ballads. So that's what made it fun, actually. It was really, really fun to think, what's the, you know, how can we do this one and make them all sound just a little bit different? 120, well, we recorded about 100 songs, I think, of the 120, and tried to make them sound a little bit different.
Yeah, and how attached, as I say, when talking about this trying to figure out what tunes are, the tunes' names will change over time potentially as well, and so there's an awful lot to try and unpack in terms of figuring out how things go together.
Yes, no, I mean, there's a fantastic piece of work by Claude Simpson in the 1960s who did this incredible research kind of tracking ballad tunes down and connecting them. So an awful lot of that work has done. We found a few new tunes and so on, but that work, a lot of that is done. But you're right. Yes, the tune would often have a name, and then if a ballad was set to it and that ballad was very successful, it might take on a new name that derived from the words of that ballad. So a tune like "Fortune My Foe," which is one of the most best known in the period, maybe has like eight, nine, ten. Different names across the period. So it is difficult. But in terms of actually finding the tunes, because they're not generally on the ballad sheets, but more kind of sophisticated composers like, you know, William Byrd and Thomas Tallis sometimes wrote variations of the tunes for lute or for virginals. And so that's where we find the tunes, that they are written down in a slightly different format. And then what you need to do is try and sort of extract the tune from the more sophisticated music and fit it back to the words. And often that works, you know, extremely well.
Angela.
I mean, I should explain, Chris could have, but the reason there are 120 and not 100 is because the 20 of the top hits, the tune cannot be found, because actually we were quite careful only to use tunes that were related to that song. And the thing that particularly interests me about the tunes that couldn't be found is that they are often tunes that could easily have been written by the very famous ballad writer that wrote the song. So, for example, of the tunes that can't be found, Lawrence Price, who was one of the top writers of the 17th century, his tunes, "Flora Farewell," there's another one as well, can't be found. And there's a couple of Martin Parker, again, very, very famous writer of the period, whose tune can't be found. Now, are we looking there at something that really was truly popular in the sense that this was a tune that people loved? You can see it being used elsewhere. Chris has done the most incredible tune histories for each of these songs. But what interests me about that is that they didn't make it into gentry papers, lute books, all the rest of it. They were, I mean, I don't know why, because obviously they're lost. We just got an absence. But it's fascinating to me that these tunes didn't survive the way that all the others did.
Mm. And what I really like about the website and how it's structured is, you know, you can just go on and look at the ballad that is presented there, listen to the ballad that's presented there, and then there are increasingly different levels of notes that follow on below each entry. And it gives you rabbit holes to go down as well that are particularly inviting. So that it's got an immediate hook for anyone who wants to go and, you know, pop into this website and have a listen to the music, but as well as things for the more specialists out there who want to dive and dig and delve a bit more into what's going on. And this is where it connects with the work we do on Beyond, putting on early modern plays. Of course, a lot of these, as I said at the beginning, feature the plots of plays, or they're featuring things that will get alluded to in plots of plays sometimes, references sometimes to mythology or subjects of that nature, which may appear in popular song. I'd say plots of plays. And it's this question of the relationship between playhouses and these songs. And how interconnected are they in competition? Are they working together? What's going on there? I'll go to Chris.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, really kind of intimate relationship between plays and ballads. It's one of the things that came out in doing the research on some of these songs, that there are several where there's either the ballad is a sort of spin-off from the play, or the play is a spin-off from the ballad. There are several examples. There's a play by Thomas Heywood written in 1599, which is about Edward IV, but it clearly takes two hit ballads, one about the Tanner of Tamworth and one about Jane Shore. And those are the sort of inspiration for it. And they were very successful ballads in the 1590s. So the playwright then kind of took these on. And there are maybe six or seven on the website where there was a play, but maybe more than that, was a play kind of strongly associated with the ballad. And sometimes one way around, sometimes the other way around. So I think they're clearly kind of feeding off one another. And it's presumably, I mean, I think Angela mentioned maybe ballad singers working in the street just outside the theatre. Maybe you come out from the theatre, someone is singing a song, you buy your copy as a souvenir as you go, or you buy it on your way in, in which case you're back to that sort of spoiler point. I mean, I think early modern people don't seem to be really bothered about spoilers in the same way that we are, because lots of the ballads have a subtitle which tells you exactly what's coming in the ballad. You know, this is a ballad about this. This is going to happen. Then this is going to happen. So it's not. I think they were not spoiler sensitive like we are.
Yes, this question, because we're not wholly certain about precisely what the playbills for plays, how much information was featured there. But if we take title pages as an indicator, you know, they will tell you all of the major exciting things that are happening in the play. You know, people always complaining with trailers, they show all of the plot. That doesn't seem to be a new thing at all. Angela.
Well, I was going to say that, absolutely. I mean, I love the way that everybody always tells you everything. Perhaps it's an early version of the trigger warning. But the other thing to just note is that there's been some really super new work by Tiffany Stern, who's shown that quite a lot of playwrights may well have actually written the ballad that then is sold. And she relates this to a couple of songs by Ben Jonson. So they appear in the play and then they also appear as broadsides. But of course, those broadsides will never have their name on them. And there could be a whole range of reasons for that. One of them is, you know, that you don't want to have your name associated with the ballad trade. And yet you know, that it's a good thing to do, because otherwise what's going to happen is somebody will have been in the theatre, they'll be writing down the song that occurs, and then they'll produce it themselves, because that was a bit of a problem, that you were constantly being hacked, you know, by people sat in the audience. And we know for sure that there are other writers who, George Wither, for example, there's a couple of songs by him. He admits that he wrote them, but they don't have his name on them. So that's around the sort of similar era. And quite a lot of authors were actors. So Thomas Jordan, for example, is an actor. Martin Parker may potentially have been an actor. Thomas Heywood was an actor and may well have written some of those songs that go with his play. So the ages, you know, I think Beyond Shakespeare's done all the ages.
Yes, we've done all the ages.
There is a ballad of all those ages, each separate one, you know. So it's quite possible. He loved songs. There's lots and lots of references to songs in Heywood's plays. And sometimes you don't know, unless you know the name of lots of songs, you wouldn't realise that this is actually a song reference or tune reference. So that kind of intertextuality is quite hard to track down, but it becomes very interesting. He was writing, so I argue, he was writing with Martin Parker just before he dies in sort of like between 37 and 38, because he and John Taylor and Martin Parker were a bit of a gang of boys, you know, they're like having a bit of fun.
Yeah, I was just thinking, because the Jane Shore in the play of Edward IV, the Jane Shore of the ballad, but also thinking back that one of the most celebrated elements of The Mirror for Magistrates is the Jane Shore poem, and I'm just sort of wondering about the sort of the various interconnected linkages that are going in there between what we might consider, you know, literature, music and drama, all sort of in conversation, and how many people would have access to one or the other. Talking about those ages plays, you know, which are, you know, obviously, for the listener at home, I say obviously, they are all about the Greek mythology. They basically tell the whole of the universe of Greek mythology. And sometimes the readers in our group are going, yeah, but who would, you know, this is all terribly elitist. You need all this classical learning. And I was pointing out, well, no, this a lot of this will be in the music, will be on the street potentially, and that may be a deliberate policy of Heywood himself to say, let's make sure they know what's going on before they watch the play.
Well, actually, one of the things that we've lost from early modern England and elsewhere, and is all the pictures of these stories in alehouses, in taverns, painted on walls outside, because we lost all that kind of iconography. It got washed over, you know, over time and all that sort of thing. So actually there were a lot of places that you could come across visual sort of stories just when you're out and about, you know, out on the street, or indeed in an alehouse or a tavern particularly, or an inn.
Back to Chris.
Yes, no, I mean, one of the things that's struck me about this project has been the fascination with kind of classical stories and classical texts. I mean, there are several. The number one ballad is the story of Dido and Aeneas. There's also the kind of Roman charity story about the woman who breastfeeds her father through the bars of his cell, and then one about the goddess Diana. So there clearly was a real fascination in late 16th and 17th century England with these kind of tales from the classics. And that interest clearly wasn't restricted to the highly educated. And then I was just going to say your point, Robert, about the kind of interrelationships between different kinds of literature. That's really, really strong. I mean, in the Heywood and the Jane Shore example, it's clear that the Jane Shore ballad learns from and quotes some of the kind of poetry that had already been written, and then the play, I think, picks up on the ballad, adds new things to it. There's all sorts of examples. There's also a great ballad about the Protestant heroine, the Duchess of Suffolk, who fled to the continent in the 1550s, and Thomas Delaunay wrote a ballad about her in the 1590s, and then there was a play in the 1620s by by Thomas Drew, all about her as well, which clearly references the ballad. The ballad references John Fox. So all these stories are kind of passing through different genres, picking up new stuff as they go.
Andy.
And I think it's really worth pointing out that the ballad at this time is essentially a narrative form of literature. When we use the word ballad in connection with contemporary music, we think of a short song, you know, often rather, you know, perhaps a sort of sentimental mood and so on. Very different from these long, long ballads which tell the whole story, and they can take 10, 15, even 20 minutes to sing through. So that, I think, is a connection with theatrical performance. And I think that sort of interrelationship in performance style is interesting. So some of our performers did take quite a dramatic approach to the way that they expressed the song. I'm thinking of Little Mouse Grove, which Vivian Ellis sings, very, very dramatic. Lucy Skeeping is somebody who tries to sort of bring out the comic element and so on. So I think there really is a connection between performance styles there.
Mm. Yes, and there are other kinds of performance, you know, going on all the time in early modern England. It's not just in the playhouses. There's plenty of entertainment, narrative entertainment that will be going on in a much more ad hoc fashion, and all over the place. I will segue, however, from the thought I was about to lead to a general one each, I think, pick. I'm not going to ask you to pick a favourite, because I wouldn't ask you to pick favourites, but pick an interesting ballad from your 120 that you'd like to mention for different reasons. If I could start with Andy, as to, especially from a musician's point of view, performing these, some of them are more dynamic than others, some of them are more active than others. Do you have a favourite sort of area within those, or one you'd like to talk about?
I think I'll talk about, Chris will put me right if I've got the title wrong, Palmas and Sheldra.
A most excellent song of the love of young Palmas and fair Sheldra.
I love this one. I love the tune. It's got a rather nice tune that comes from a Scottish source. Who knows where it was first devised. It may not be Scottish in origin, but from something called the Skene manuscript. Very nice fiddle tune, so it's got some dancey feeling, and it's got sort of classical allusions, but it's basically the story of this sort of love affair that goes on, that's on and off and on and off between the ferryman, presumably a sort of Thames side, you know, waterman, and there's a sort of tragic ending to it, because he gets drowned, I think, doesn't he, in the waves, but it's got a bit of a sort of it's got a real humorous twist to it, which I think communicates itself even to a modern audience. So I love that, because it relates, we can relate to it.
Chris?
If I can just add to what Andy was saying, I think one of the things that creates the humour in that song is it's got a very kind of bouncy, lively, jolly tune, but it's actually quite tragic love story unfolding, and the sort of discrepancy between the kind of mood of the tune and the mood of the narrative, I think creates a kind of tension and a kind of humour.
Yes, often with modern songs, you have incredibly cheerful, incredibly cheerful, bouncy music, and it's just the most depressing of narratives going on underneath, or more disturbing narratives sometimes. Angela, do you have a one to leap on?
Well, so most of the things that I like the best come a bit late for Beyond Shakespeare, so I picked a different one. Because actually it does have really interesting political significance as well. So this is number 57, The Shepherd and the King, and of Gillian the Shepherd's Wife and Her Churlish Answer. So, you know, nice snappy title. And what's brilliant about this song is that you can imagine it being performed. And it's all about King Alfred, who decides that he's going to dress up as a kind of travelling beggar and go and meet some of his people. So he meets up with the shepherd. The shepherd, and it looks exactly like a Robin Hood. There's a Robin Hood song that does almost exactly the same thing, where he says, "You think you can come along here and tell me you're going to have dinner with me? Well, first you'll have to fight me." So the king is forced to have a fight with the shepherd. The shepherd kind of defeats him. And of course, interesting, that also happens to Robin Hood. And then he goes to have to, you know, live with the shepherd, and he's all right with everything. Gillian has a really good go at him because he burns the cakes, and Chris suggests that this is what made everybody know about the burnt cakes. I mean, maybe it did. But being in bed with a sheepskin and cobwebs over his head is just too much for him. So then when he gets up in the morning, he blows his horn. Shepherd and Gillian go, "Oh my God, you know, he's a robber. All these people are going to come rob us." And an enormous army turns up, and the shepherd does very well out of it. So it's a happy ending. Well, hold on. So why I am interested in this song in particular, so apart from the fact it is supremely performable, there are loads of hilarious bits. That song is used for so many political songs later. So the idea of the king who is, you know, turns up and demonstrates his humanity effectively and the way he cares about the people by being, you know, somebody who will go and actually meet with the ordinary people. The idea of the king in disguise who ends up burning something because he doesn't know how to work the kitchen. Charles II, a story is told of Charles II, there are ballads about that as well, where he gets told off because he doesn't know how to use the kitchen equipment that will bring something up out of the fire, can't mend it, and so on. And it's particularly interesting after the revolution, because King William is, there are several songs of King William doing this exact thing, only he doesn't have to get dressed up in nasty clothes or anything. And the words of the song actually say, "We haven't had a king like this for a long time." Yes. So whoever it was wrote that one and put it out in the retail trade probably got paid, you know, a healthy sum by somebody in power. So it's a fascinating song. And the other thing is, Gillian becomes a kind of byword for, you know, a kind of like grouchy old woman. You know, you want to watch yourself. And there's a lovely line in here where he stands in doubt. Gillian tells him off. And after that, the king stands in doubt where he is with Gillian. She's frightened the life out of him. So it's just brilliant. There's so much that's really good in it.
Chris.
Yeah, and I was just going to add to that. There are actually three of those ballads in the list of hits that are kind of king meets commoner. So that was such a popular device. And that, you know, they're kind of, they reference each other like this, the Tanner of Tamworth and the Miller of Mansfield. So that was really very, very kind of very successful as a kind of trope that people loved.
There's a later one as well, King of the Abbot, isn't there? But in fact the featured sheet that we put up is actually a much later sheet. There's an earlier sheet. And the earlier sheet actually has got a little picture of what's going on it. It's a shame that would go. Obviously, you know, went missing at some stage, so they couldn't use it anymore.
Yes, because there's a whole breed of history play which is all about the king and meeting a commoner in some fashion. The history plays where tend to be, they're not so much about history, but they're set in history. We've sort of got this the two strands of history play, of the one where we're going to engage in actual the events of the time, and another one, we have a king. He's named the king of the time, but he has no necessary connection with the actual events that occurred.
And that's what makes songs important, right? Because I mean, there is a, you know, there's strong literature that tries to suggest that ballads and news, they were a news-giving, you know, kind of medium. This is clearly nonsense. So ballads do not tell you the news. I mean, they barely care two hoots whether they told you anything that's actually true or not. The key thing is the ideas that they're trying to get over, the feelings they're trying to get over, and that's why, you know, particular ideas or vehicles for telling those ideas get reused over and over then with different people in, as do all the classical stories, of course. I mean, you often get people just reworking a classical story, sticking in some modern people and saying, here's my new story.
Chris, do you have a particular ballad to talk of?
Yeah, I was going to pick out one called The Honour of a London Prentice, which is probably written in the late 16th century, printed throughout the into the 17th, the 18th century, was collected as a folk song in Nova Scotia in the 1950s. So it has a long, long, long life. And it's the story of an apprentice from London who's sent to Turkey by his master. He wins a jousting tournament at the court of the Sultan. Sultan then sets his son on the London apprentice. The London apprentice predictably kills the son in a fight because he's just such a such a patriotic, manly English chap. So the Sultan then feeds him to the lions, and the brave apprentice manages to kill both the lions by sticking his hands down their throats and pulling their hearts out. The Sultan is then so impressed by this that he gives one of his daughters to the London apprentice in sort of thanks and in gratitude. And it's just it's a brilliant song. We have a great recording by Nancy Kerr singing, and Raf Mizraki, who's playing the bones, just a very basic accompaniment. And it's a fascinating story. It presents the apprentice as a kind of patriotic, loyal hero. He works for his master. He stands up for his country. But he's also heroic, violent, kind of defiant. So he will have appealed to kind of young apprentices in London. It's a sort of escapist ballad. He's kind of like a modern version of a chivalric superhero. It has exotic location set in Turkey with the Sultan, and it just lasted so long, and it has one of these woodcut pictures on it, which is kind of like an early version of a comic strip where it shows the three main events, you know, one after the other. So that's my pick.
Yes, and the moment you started outlining that plot, I was sitting there going, is that written by Thomas Hayward of INHR? Because it echoes, there are quite a few plays that do similar things, some of them by Thomas Hayward. It does seem that the idea of the heroic prentice obviously goes down well with the theatre-going audiences that will have a reasonable percentage of them in the audience themselves. So it seems to be something that, so off the top of my head, Thomas Hayward does quite a lot, actually.
Interesting.
I mean, the thing about it is as well that it clearly was lurking about. People knew it, but actually there's no evidence of it being published before 1656. Well, actually that means the 1650s for reasons I shan't bother going into. but it's interesting. So somewhere this song is moving around and it doesn't actually show itself to us, the historians, in the in-between time, because, you know, it's definitely known probably by 1639. That's one of the problems of history there.
Well, yeah. and talking about history, as it were, problems of history, which is that texts disappear, including obviously ballads, but also that within some of the ballads that you've collected here are potentially the plots balladized from plays that we no longer have, and that they remain there as sources and as things to be, you know, potentially used to semi-reconstruct what was going on. Are there any ones of those anyone wants to leap in on? I've got some notes that have been sent to me, so we've got the Page of Plymouth, I think, is that one?
Yeah.
There's Page of Plymouth, and also the one about the English merchant, both of which there are lost plays, like Page of Plymouth, lost play 1599, and then the English merchant, there was a play called The Merchant of Emden put on in 1594. Henslow mentions having taken £3.08 from its first performance. But these are ones where we can't be sure in these cases which way around it is, whether it's the play that then generates the ballad, or whether it's the ballad that generated the play. I mean, we have documented examples of it, of both of those happening. But often it's often you know both appeared in the 1590s, but it's really impossible, especially because one is lost, to work out which one came first. But yeah, kind of intimate relationship between plays and ballads.
I mean, from a documentary point of view, plays are much more visibly licensed than ballads are. And so, you know, in that sense, you might be able to get some dating, you know, information between the two. And the fact that playwrights themselves probably produced some of these ballads as well and were perfectly happy for those stories to be out there, you know, to encourage people to come in and simply to let people know more. You know, it's possible that they kind of like very frequently went together. I mean, we'll never know, and especially not from this earlier part of the century when in the 30s, there was a big clampdown. So you get much, much better recording in the 30s as a decade than at any other point, almost certainly in the first half of the century. So, but if it's outside of that framework, it's always so difficult.
Mm. And on another sort of area of music / theatre crossover, how much crossover and connection is there with things like jigs? So theatrical jigs, at the end of the show, you would have effectively a lengthy comedy story told through song and dance, of which we have elements surviving. But is there much crossover or connection with the ballads that you've looked at, or ballads in general?
Yes, no, I think there definitely is. I mean, I think an Elizabethan Jacobean jig after the show is effectively a ballad being acted out. I don't think any of our particular hits are known to have, you know, been jigs as well. But clearly, you know, sometimes jigs were printed as ballads with a sort of almost like a script. So I think people would have understood a jig as what they were watching was a ballad being performed and acted out. I also think the jig is the weirdest thing to watch, a tragedy, and then it ends with a kind of, you know, rompy bawdy kind of jig, and you go home with that in your mind rather than the terrible tragedy you've just spent 3 hours watching. So
It's one of those things that when we're reading through plays, we have this thing that we call late onset missing clown disorder. It's like the clown will be very heavy, and you always have to remind everyone, well, the reason the clown's gone is either because of doubling or because he's resting before he's got to do his massive physical song and dance number at the end, because right. You know, right. they could be very extensive, and we can only sort of see them through a glass darkly. We can't really get a sense, and we have started reading them just the words at this stage for the Beyond projects, as we're looking at, you know, adding them to our repertoire if we can. But it's very difficult to know precisely what actually how far to take them. Angela.
Well, I, you were saying something earlier about how the theatres were not the only place where performances happened, of course. And so this multiple, highly diverse repertoire, when you start looking at the people who are travelling round, so ballad singers like actors, you know, travelling actors and so on, they all have to have licences to be able to perform. Not that that will save you from being bunged in prison, obviously, if the local authorities take a guinea, but still. And certainly from what I see, and I mean, this is a question to you really, but then when you know, you've got a fiddler and his boy saying they're in the tavern or an inn or an alehouse, which means they're never going to get any money at all, and they say, what would you like? What music would you have? So is this also the same with travelling players? And by the way, some of these fiddlers and singers are with travelling players. They're actually travelling with troops of players. Do they get asked to do or give us something that's really funny, or give us something that, you know, so they're being told they want something, and then they have to dig something from their repertoire and just perform it, perhaps with only half an hour, 2 hours to prepare. Would that be something that happens, do you think?
Are you asking me or who?
I'm asking you. I mean, that's not particularly our territory, but it just strikes me that the way in which these things are constructed out of lots of bits would be very helpful kind of repertoire. since most actors must actually be travelling rather than fixed.
I think certainly when it comes to things like clowns who seem to be connected with song and music slightly more than, say, the more tragic end of the actor repertoire, we know that they're out hustling and doing other gigs and battling their wits in improvisatory contests. And I would not be surprised if they have all sorts of things like this in their repertoire, depending on what kind of, you know, clown or comic they are. I know as a performer and I know as a storyteller that you can hold on to your repertoire for an incredibly long time and then pull it out of your bag much later. And I actually, this is where I might go to Andy, of just saying, you know, as a musician, you know, how many stock pieces do you have potentially in your gander bag to pull out? If the crowd look like they're going one way as opposed to the set list you had in mind, is that something that maybe connects to today?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this comes back to what I was saying about the ballad singers and the ballad sellers being musically competent, even if they were musically illiterate. And they presumably, you know, knew a really good number of tunes, just as any, you know, self-respecting, you know, folk musician or any musician really would do today. Actually, one of the things that I like to do with my students, I teach baroque bassoon at the Birmingham Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, and often quite early on in their career, in the first year, or whatever, the student will come in to the room, and they'll set up the instrument, and I'll just say, "Okay, play me a tune," and you'd be surprised how many of them look aghast because they just haven't acquired that professional skill of being able to pull something out of the bag. I think, you know, although, I mean, Chris and Angela, I'm sure, can give many accounts of ballad singers and sellers being disparaged and being, you know, criticised about their awful singing and their, you know, I think that actually, they were astute performers. You know, otherwise they wouldn't make a living. You know, they must have been good enough to sell. And so, yeah.
And I'm thinking actually to you know, experience of trying to do any street performing. If you're trying to sell and you're trying to attract a crowd, volume and attack is more important than necessarily the beauty of what you're doing. So actually, there may be a differentiation between the initial pitch and then once you've got people a bit closer, then you can do some. So that actually, it's only awful if you're 100 feet away, as opposed to the people that they're actually engaging with, that might be quite different. Chris?
I was actually going to say exactly that, Robert, that the priority is on volume if you're standing in a marketplace, and that can easily then be presented as kind of raucous, rough. Mm. And that then becomes a kind of trope that everybody uses. The ballad singer is terrible, and then that feeds off itself for decades. So, yes, I agree with that.
Mm. And it's also important to remember that actually, I mean, from all the stuff I've been dragging up for this brilliant book, quite a lot of people are not selling. They're buyers. They're buyers of ballads. And then they learn the ballads and they use it for their repertoire. So actually, it's surprising how few ballad singers sell. Selling is a separate thing. I mean, I think some ballad singers will sell, but they don't need to sell to make their living. For the real ballad singers, what they're doing is singing, and they are picking up new repertoire. They've got to be up to date and so on. I mean, that's very, very noticeable from the different people you're finding as they get picked up and as things happen. They get into trouble, sure. I mean, they're riotous. I mean, a lot of them are. You know, one of the reasons they get into trouble is because they like to drink late and entertain a lot of people. You know, they're kind of like early rock stars in a way and disparaged for it because they're completely contrary to the way that the local magistrates are hoping to keep everybody quiet and all the rest of it. But people love them, and they rescue them if they get into trouble as well. That happens. So.
As we're sort of into the closing moments, the question sort of for each of you is anything that you've you think we haven't covered that you'd like to throw in? But also, is there anything more to come? We have 120 lovely things on a website. Is there more work to come on this, or more work in different ways? So, sort of final thoughts, anything you want to throw in, and I say anything more. Angela, is there anything more?
Well, definitely go and look at the website. It's truly fabulous. I'm so proud to have been part of it. It's been amazing. I've learned a huge amount. Anyone will learn something or get some pleasure from it. I could plug the fact that I'm just about finishing up a book and it's going to go off, and that's going to be, if anybody wants to know about the history of the ballad trade and its politics, there we are. But particularly the ballad trade part, because actually people don't really know about the ballad trade. So it will be helpful. And that's played quite a big part in the choosing of the 100 ballads, is the, you know, the actual business of those particular songs.
Chris?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not really kind of changing the website anymore. It's kind of done. But I mean, areas I'd like to see work on. I'd kind of like to see more musicologists taking an interest in balladry and ballad tunes. They've tended not to tackle it, although it's changing a little bit. But I think there's really interesting stuff on how ballad tunes move between sort of courtly music and street music, and I think there's more to be done with that. And then I suppose also just the idea that this industry is perhaps the origins of a sort of commercially organized popular music industry, and I think that's something which I hope will be kind of taken up and can be further explored and developed.
And Andy, anything more?
Well, I think the next stage, and it's probably for others to take forward rather than me at this stage of my career, is to really explore ways of performing these songs, because they are worth performing. That's not to say that there aren't some difficulties in making them approachable for a modern audience, but I think it can be done. We've mentioned already the idea of outdoor performance. This is something that we weren't able to do, but I think we would learn a lot by doing some outdoor gigs, unamplified, in a noisy environment, and seeing what happened. So I think there are wonderful experiments to be done with the performance of these songs, and I hope that musicians will take them up and use them.
Well, I a couple of takeaways I've taken from this, just on the performing these things on the streets. We on the pod have done reconstructions of Lord Mayor's shows, and the music element there was a really wonderful element. We had Passamezzo doing some songs to go with the actual reconstruction, but also as part of our shows, we've been playing around with pre-shows when we're doing a live play reading. We've done random bits of texts, and we've been doing stuff to just get everybody's ears tuned in, but actually maybe throwing some ballads in as part of the pre-show mix might be really quite fun. I have a project in mind almost immediately from one of the songs. And actually I'm quite interested in pitching them to non-specialist musicians, you know, people who can sing, but say, well, here's the tune, here's what it sounds, you know, here are the words, now have a play and see what actually comes out of that. Because I think there's that sort of on the go folk tradition fits it quite nicely, actually. So I'm very enthused. Well, all that remains to thank my wonderful guests, Angela McShane, Christopher Marsh, and Andy Watts. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.